What makes you rejoice? What makes you not just feel a bit happy on the inside, but so happy that you need to throw a party? We celebrate for all sorts of reasons. Sometimes we celebrate just because we've got 10 kilos of taco mince in the fridge. We don't really need a reason. New Year's Eve, I reckon it's the same kind of thing. There's no real reason for the celebration, but everyone gets into it anyway. I suppose there's a small sense that New Year's Eve is celebrating that we survived another year, but really it's just a party. There's nothing deeper behind it. We celebrate people. I think that's what birthday parties are about. We celebrate the existence of a person, which is a pretty cool thing to do. A big part of rejoicing is rejoicing in victory. When your sporting team wins, or even if it just gets to the finals, it's party time. We had a holiday in Melbourne last year, and before we booked, we had no idea that we were going to be in Melbourne for grand final week. Melbourne is sports mad on a scale that we just don't get up here in Brisbane. People wearing team colours and scarves everywhere. Celebrating the grand final is a big deal. And does that remind you of something we read in 2 Samuel? Just a little bit? Yeah. Anyway, after the London Olympic Games, we celebrated the victory of the Australian athletes, and there was a ticker tape parade through the centre of the city. It was our way of celebrating their victory. But it's not just sporting victory. At the end of World War II, there was dancing in the streets and amazing celebrations when the soldiers came home. They celebrated not just the victory over an enemy, but that after years of fighting and countless lives wasted, the end was finally here. Peace had come. Each year, Jewish people have heaps and heaps of scheduled religious Jewish parties. We're probably familiar with Passover. It's probably the big one we know about. It's coming up really soon. It's about Easter time. Passover is a festival where the Jews remember how God rescued his people from slavery in Egypt. Another festival, this one I think we know a lot less about, is Purim. Purim has some similarities to Passover. It's also about celebrating God's rescue. Purim is the festival where the Jews remember the events of the Book of Esther, how God rescued his people from the genocide that Haman planned. It's held each year, and this year, it was just a couple of weeks back actually, it was on March 5 and 6 this year. As we just heard in the reading, it's called Purim after a word that basically means dice, or more literally cube. If you remember back in Esther chapter 3 verse 7, Haman throws a couple of dice to work out when it was he was going to kill the Jews. I reckon it's a bit funny that they named their celebration after the instrument that worked out the day that they were all going to die. Maybe it's a bit of an ironic thing. Although the dice was meant to say the day of their death, it ended up saying the day that God rescued them. Christians are commanded to rejoice. In Philippians, Paul tells us to rejoice in the Lord. He says it quite a few times in that book. It sounds like a pretty simple instruction, doesn't it? He's not asking us to run a marathon, just to be happy in Jesus. But I know this is something that I find hard to do, and I suspect that it's something that many of us find hard to do. More often than not, I feel anxious. I'm weighed down by concerns about all the things I've got to do today. I'm worried about the future and the uncertainty that faces me. I'm concerned about my kids. There's my sin, which as I reflect on it, it just makes me feel like rubbish. And there's the moments of gnawing doubt. All of these things can make it hard to rejoice in the Lord. Well, as we dig into these final events of Esther tonight, I hope we're going to see God and be encouraged as we look at the book of Esther and how the book of Esther ends, to be people who rejoice in Jesus. We've been reading the story of Esther now for 2 weeks. In the first week, we looked at how in Esther, God is in the shadows. And I think this was good for us to reflect on. In the whole book of Esther, it's been the same, but we really reflected on that in the first week, because the way that life just goes on in the book of Esther without God actually being mentioned, but him always working in the background, that's how we feel, isn't it? Often we struggle to see God at work, but God is at work even in the background. And not only is God in the shadows in the book of Esther, I reckon that Esther and Mordecai and the Jews would have felt abandoned by God as Haman made a law to annihilate God's people. But at the end of that first week we spent in Esther, we heard Mordecai's muted faith in God. He had this desperate faith that somehow, from somewhere, God would raise up a deliverer. And maybe that's why Esther had become queen over the Persian Empire. Last week we saw how God worked through this beautiful, ironic, poetic justice, through this series of coincidences. Haman, the enemy of the Jews, ends up dead, impaled on the stake that he had set up for Mordecai. God has brought justice. God has delivered his people. Well, almost. At the end of chapter 7, where we finished last week, Haman is dead and Xerxes is satisfied with that. The king's fury subsided. But the law still stands. The date is still set. The dice have still been rolled when the people are free to kill any Jew they like. Even with Haman dead, his plan isn't. And tonight we're going to see how Esther and Mordecai solve this problem by turning the tables. Actually, God turns the tables, doesn't he? But Esther and Mordecai do a whole lot of stuff. So we're up to, Haman is now dead, and King Xerxes is now short his 2IC. And so Mordecai, surprise, surprise, is given the position that Haman used to have. And then King Xerxes also gives all of Haman's property and land to Esther. And so Esther and Mordecai now have heaps and heaps of power. They are number 2 and 3 in the kingdom, and they use their newfound power to work out a way around Haman's law. Back in chapter 8, verse 3, Esther approaches the king another time. There's another moment with the scepter. And she asks Xerxes to authorize a new law to overrule Haman's. And Xerxes gives Esther and Mordecai the authority to write their own law, just like he'd done with Haman. So we're in chapter 8.
We're looking at verse 7.
Chapter 8 and verse 7. King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, "Because Haman attacked the Jews, I have given his estate to Esther, and they have impaled him on the pole he set up. Now write another decree in the king's name, in behalf of the Jews, as seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked." Now, these Persian kings have a bit of a problem when it comes to authorizing laws that they can't undo. It was a problem for Darius with Daniel in the book of Daniel, and it's a problem again here. The problem is they can't just undo the law. They can't just go and write a law that says, "Oh, sorry, everyone, ignore that first law about killing all the Jews. I've changed my mind." So instead, Esther and Mordecai write another law that also can't be revoked. Hopefully it doesn't need to be, you know, doubly unrevoked later on. But Esther and Mordecai write what I think might be their only option. They can't just undo the old law. And so they write the opposite law to what Haman originally wrote. And they write a law that says that if the Jews are attacked on the 13th day of Adar, then they are free to defend themselves. So verse 11, chapter 8, verse 11. "The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate the armed men of any nationality or province who might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. A copy of the text of the edict was to be issued as law in every province and made known to the people of every nationality so that the Jews would be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies." Now, although we might wish that Xerxes had just swallowed his pride and properly just revoked the first law, I reckon Esther and Mordecai's law is fair enough in that culture. You know, it's permission for self-defense. And maybe I'm being a bit optimistic here, but maybe there's this hope that by writing this new law, it's going to stop people from attacking the Jews. Everyone gets to hear this law. They knew that the Jews are now going to be ready for them and are authorized to give self-defense. Maybe they were hoping that what would result is peace. Well, this law is sent out for the entire empire to read. And Mordecai goes, after the law's been sent out, he leaves the palace, and when he steps out onto the street wearing royal clothes, the people of Susa just go crazy. They cheer and they party, especially the Jews. Mordecai is their hero. He and Esther have got rid of Haman. It seems like he was hated by everyone. Haman is gone, and now the Jews don't have a ticking time bomb clock. So the scene is now set, and chapter 9, we're up to now, chapter 9 jumps forward to that day, the 13th day of Adar, D-Day, Judgment Day. It was meant to be the last day of the Jews, but the tables have been turned, and now the Jews have the upper hand. But it seems like the mobs haven't really got with the program. They haven't understood what this meant. We read at the beginning of chapter 9 that the rulers and nobles get with the program. They get on side with Esther and Mordecai and the Jews. We even read at the end of chapter 8 that some people become Jews. Now, whether that means that they truly converted to worship Yahweh, the God of Isaac, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, or whether it just means that they started getting on side with Jewish people, we don't know. But these people get with the program. They realize the Jews are in power. Let's side with the Jews. But even with the Jews being some of the most powerful people in the empire, even though they've got the king and the nobles on their side, there are some people who don't get with the program. They still hate God's people so much that they attack the Jews. And the result is government-approved rioting throughout the empire, even in the capital city, and the enemies of God's people are devastated. So we're at chapter 9 now, chapter 9, verse 11. Chapter 9, verse 11. The number of those killed in the citadel of Susa was reported to the king that same day. The king said to Queen Esther, "The Jews have killed and destroyed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman in the citadel of Susa. What have they done in the rest of the king's provinces? Now, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? It will also be granted." Now, it's hard to tell here whether the king is shocked. 500 people dead? What else do you want, Queen Esther? Or whether this is actually what he expected to happen, and he genuinely wants to give his queen whatever it is she wants. Well, Esther takes up his offer. She asks for another day for the Jews to defend themselves. One day of rioting and 500 people dead is not enough for Esther. It may be that at this point, Esther has let her power get to her head. Or maybe she knew that there were still people out there who had it in for the Jews, and that this was her one chance to protect her people properly from their enemies. I reckon that it is self-defense, but it wouldn't be the first time that a leader of God's people has let power get to their head. So I'll keep reading verse 13. "If it pleases the king," Esther answered, "give the Jews in Susa permission to carry out this day's edict tomorrow also, and let Haman's 10 sons be impaled on poles." So the king commanded that this be done. An edict was issued in Susa, and they impaled the 10 sons of Haman. The Jews in Susa came together on the 14th day of the month of Adar, and they put to death in Susa 300 men. But they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Meanwhile, the remainder of the Jews who were in the king's provinces and also assembled to protect themselves and get relief from their enemies, they killed 75,000 of them, but did not lay their hands on the plunder. This happened on the 13th day of the month of Adar, and on the 14th they rested and had a day of feasting and joy. 75,000 people are dead. The scale of what's happened here, it's humongous. It's beyond belief. And this we're just counting the baddies who are dead here. There's no mention of any Jew dying, and maybe that's true, but I doubt it. There was a lot of blood spilt on these 2 days. But what shocks me just as much is, the way it's presented in Esther anyway, this is self-defense. There were 75,000 people throughout the Persian Empire who hated God's people enough to keep rioting and fighting even when it was clear that the Jews had the upper hand. It points to a deep hatred of God's people. But this is the good news side of Esther. This deep hatred has been defeated. It's the 13th day of Adar, it's the 14th day of Adar. The Jews have not been destroyed as Haman planned by the people who hate them. They've been destroyed. Haman and the people who hate God's people have been destroyed. And because of this, because God has delivered his people from annihilation, the people celebrated. The people decided that since this has been such an incredible deliverance, such an amazing victory, it's worth celebrating not just once, but every year. We'll pick it up halfway through verse 26. So we're still in chapter 9 and verse 26. Because of everything written in Mordecai's letter, and because of what they had seen and what had happened to them, the Jews took it on themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. These days should be remembered and observed in every generation by every family and in every province and in every city. And these days of Purim should never fail to be celebrated by the Jews, nor should the memory of these days die out among their descendants. And so, even today, Jews around the world celebrate Purim. I've never been to a Purim party. Has anyone ever been to one? I expect you have. But from what I've read on myjewishlearnings.com, it is a crazy party. People get dressed up in costumes. That's the left-hand picture. These symbolise how, and also the top right one actually as well, that guy's in a crazy costume. These symbolise how nothing was quite as it seemed in the days of Esther. Remember, Esther herself was in disguise in the palace, didn't tell anyone who she really was. It was also nothing as it seemed. It seemed that Haman would win the day, but he didn't. They eat Hamantaschen. They're the triangle pastries down the bottom right-hand corner. Some people think these are to remember that Haman used to wear a three-cornered hat. But others think, you think that one's good, I like this one better, they symbolise Haman's ears. The story goes that back in those days, they would cut off your ears before they execute you. Maybe I'm strange, but I like the idea that symbolically we eat the ears of our vanquished enemy. How cool is that? I love this party. That's not, because it's pastry cannibalism. It's okay. They also give each other gifts and gifts to the poor. They read the book of Esther and remember the good news of how God delivered them, how God rescued them from genocide. This is worth celebrating, isn't it? To be rescued from genocide. We rejoice when our footy team makes it to the grand final. When we graduate from school or uni, we throw a big party, we rejoice in the victory. Yes, we've conquered our exams. Purim celebrates an amazing victory, rejoicing in God's victory for his people. All right, so we've looked at the book of Esther now for 3 weeks. What's it about? If there's, one thing we can get out of the book of Esther, at least know what it's about. If you can actually apply what it's about, that's even better. But Esther is a book about deliverance, about salvation. Despite all the problems, and this is a book that's got lots of questions and unknowns and things you go, oh, is that really something that God's people should do? It is a book about God rescuing his people from certain death at the hands of their enemies. And it's a book about rejoicing and celebration. This book is chock-a-block full of banquets and feasts. Some of them are bad banquets. But at the end, by the time we get to the end, the feasting is something we can celebrate and rejoice in, and something we can approve of. It ends with this command to celebrate and rejoice in God's deliverance. Surprisingly, there's nowhere in the New Testament where Christians are told to have special celebrations. There's no command to celebrate Good Friday, Easter Sunday, or Christmas Day. That's not in the Bible at all, which is pretty shocking, especially because in Australia, people keep pushing to keep Jesus in these celebrations, but they're not celebrations that are commanded in the Bible at all. It's also surprising because as you read through the Old Testament, it does command, all the way through the Old Testament, it does command a number of feasts and celebrations. You've got Purim, Passover, the Feast of Booths and of Weeks, and then you've got the regular Sabbath day celebrations as well. Why is this? Why is it that the Old Testament is full of parties and feasts, but not the New? It could be that the New Testament just wants us to be boring people, but no. I reckon this is because with the coming of Jesus and the good news of the deliverance and salvation that is freely available to anyone, Jew or Gentile, Christians don't just rejoice in God's salvation on special days and with a religious feast. We rejoice in God's deliverance all the time. It should be the character of the Christian life is rejoicing. In Philippians, as we saw at the start, Paul commands Christians to rejoice. My brothers and sisters, rejoice in the Lord. And then he says it in chapter 4 even more emphatically, rejoice in the Lord always. I say it again, rejoice. This is a command to rejoice, not just on special days, not just once a year on the 5th of March, but every day is a day of rejoicing. But for many of us, this is hard. Anxiety, worries, depression, sin, it weighs us down. To make rejoicing in the Lord, which should be an easy thing to do, it makes it hard. But the book of Esther reminds us to look on God's deliverance, to go to the gospel, to remember and reflect on how incredible God's deliverance is. As we read the end of the book of Esther today, you go, well, of course you're going to throw a party at the end of this experience. You know, you're not dead. It's a day to celebrate. This is a big deal. Well, if that's how we feel as we get to the end of the book of Esther, God's rescue of us in Jesus, it's one of those how much more kind of things. You read in some translations of the Bible, how much more. We should be rejoicing more and celebrating harder in Jesus. At Purim, the Jews rejoice because they remember that God rescued them from undeserved destruction of their race. God rescued them from undeserved genocide. As Christians, we look back in history to the moment when God rescued us. But we don't look to Mordecai or Esther, who have their foibles, as our heroes, but to Jesus. And when we look to the gospel of Jesus, we see that Jesus didn't rescue us from undeserved annihilation. On the cross, Jesus takes on himself the destruction that we deserve. He takes our sin on himself that we'll be saved from the annihilation that we deserve. Purim is about rejoicing in God's deliverance from the undeserved destruction of their race. How much more should followers of Jesus rejoice as we know that God will rescue us from the deserved destruction of our race? Esther is also a story of God's victory. Haman loses, God wins. It's a pretty simple story. Haman loses, God wins. People rejoice when their enemies are defeated, when the war is won. But it was only a temporary peace. Even in the few hundred years between the time of Esther and the time of Jesus, the Jews face again a few really, really nasty enemies. But the peace that Jesus has won is full and final. In the gospel, a greater enemy has been beaten. In his death, Jesus has conquered sin, death, and the devil. We can rejoice because war is over. Jesus has won. How can we rejoice in the Lord always? How can we celebrate God's deliverance? Well, by keeping the gospel of Jesus close in our thoughts, reflecting on what we have been saved from, who has saved us, and the victory that is won for us. Let's pray. Father God, please help us to rejoice in the Lord, to rejoice in knowing Jesus. When we're overwhelmed by anxiety or stress, when we realize our guilt and shame, please help us to rejoice in Jesus, to look back to the cross and resurrection, and to know that he did this for us and for our salvation. Please help us to rejoice.